I hope that I have something to add, because I feel so much has been covered, and I feel so much in common with the interpretation that Mark has just given you. I'm an historian of Japanese history. I'm not a specialist on Ukraine. I don't believe that Mark is either, but being an historian, I do have the inclination in looking at any particular problem to try to look at it in broad context. And that's the sort of thing that you absolutely do not find in the mass media. You absolutely have no sense that events in contemporary Ukraine have anything to do at all with NATO. And you're hard-pressed to find any reference to neo-fascists in this context at all. So when I look at the questions posed on the flyer that was circulated for today's event, the question that stood out to me is, how should the peace movement respond to rising tensions between the two biggest nuclear powers and the U.S. shift towards covert war? And my answer to that is, my opinion on this, is that first of all, we need to educate ourselves about what is going on. We need to discover the facts, which is the point of this meeting tonight. The media obviously is not going to give us too many of the facts, and so we have to look on the internet or unusual sources of information. But again, I think that what is particularly being ignored is the NATO aspect and the presence of neo-fascists in the putsch regime that has taken power. The facts will show, as we have been told, that the Ukraine crisis is mainly, if not entirely, about NATO expansion and Russian responses, and not about Russian expansion and Putin's imagined goal of reestablishing the USSR or the old Tsarist Empire, because this has been repeated again and again in the media, and of course prominent politicians and even Prince Charles have repeated this analogy between Hitler's seizure of the Sudetenland in 1938 and the annexation of the Crimea. And I think that the peace movement should not respond to the situation by taking sides, either of course by endorsing NATO and U.S. imperialism, or by endorsing Russia in its annexation of Crimea, even if we do understand that as a preemptive measure to prevent Sevastopol from forever falling into NATO hands and the Black Sea being transformed into a NATO lake. We should, however, expose the steady expansion of NATO, make it clear to people that there is a pattern here of relentless expansion, and also talk about NATO's character as, for example, revealed in the bombardment of Libya most recently, with increasingly conspicuously disastrous consequences. I want to start with these two conflicting views of what happened culminating in February. And I'll call them the U.S. and Russian views, it being understood, of course, that in both countries there are lots of different views and our views and so on. But when I say the U.S. view, I mean the view of the U.S. State Department that is very immediately, consistently reiterated by the cable news networks. And when I mention the Russian point of view, I'm talking about that of the Russian Foreign Ministry and that I find in RT television. Does anybody else watch RT TV, channel 280, if you have Dish? It is insightful and very interesting. I recommend it, even if you access it online. The U.S. view. The Ukrainian people have long held what Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, calls European aspirations. So, which is to say that they don't want to be close to Russia anymore. They want to be part of Europe. It's a very vague concept. They want to be part of European values, the presumption being that Russians don't hold the same values. But Nuland last November at a Chevron-hosted gathering in the U.S., boasted that the U.S. had invested $5 billion in democracy and in Ukraine and in encouraging European aspirations. So last year, after President Yanukovych had tentatively agreed to an association arrangement with the EU, he rethought it. And why is this? Because Vladimir Putin had presented him with a better offer. Or rather, I think that if it were submitted to a group of economists, they might be divided about the benefits of this or the other option. But when it was announced that no, Ukraine would not sign the agreement of association with the EU, then there was a great deal of opposition, as though the people had been betrayed. I don't know all the aspects of the tentative agreement with Russia, but it did involve continued supply of natural gas at 30% discount, and also something like a $15 billion loan. So it was a substantial offer that Yanukovych decided to accept. However, not ruling out later a modified agreement with the EU. By the way, a European Union association agreement is simply defined as a treaty between the EU and a non-EU country that creates a framework for cooperation with sections on political, trade, social, cultural, and security links. As of now, an agreement has indeed been signed, but the trade aspects of it have not yet been worked out. Anyway, in outrage at this decision by Yanukovych, hundreds of thousands of people rallied in the Maidan, in the square in Kiev, with the encouragement of the United States. Nuland herself appeared in the square, so did Senator McCain. And according to the U.S. narrative, the security forces ran amok, behaved very brutally, firing on the people, killing over 100, resulting in Yanukovych losing support and being overthrown February 23rd by a popular protest, a kind of genuine people's uprising. Arseniy Yatsenyuk, a banker who had earlier been in the Ukrainian administration, known to favor EU and NATO admission. So headed by Yatsenyuk as a prime minister and President Oleksandr Turchynov. But, the U.S. interpretation continues, Russia didn't like this. And it's all very personalized. Putin was upset by this because he wanted to control the Ukraine. And so he whips up dissatisfaction in the East and the South. So it's this familiar theme of outside agitators producing this dissatisfaction in the East. And Putin continues by organizing a bogus referendum in Crimea and conducting military exercises along the eastern border to intimidate Ukraine. And that is the situation. Now, the Russian view is markedly different. No, there was not a popular uprising that legitimately ousted a government. The events of February 17 to 23 were a putsch. You don't often hear that word, but it means a rather coordinated and rapid and brutal seizure of power. It's not your typical coup, but something that's organized in order to terrify people and use the conditions in order to seize power. That's what the Russians are calling it. And in this putsch, vitally, there was the participation of neo-fascist armed groups. Now, there's a particular significance of this in the Ukraine because there has been historically an active, large-scale fascist movement. And if you watch RT television, you'll be well educated about this history, but I think few people really associate the Ukraine with a history of fascism. But a figure that is most associated with this movement, Stefan Bandera, is the hero of the Svoboda, or so-called Freedom Party, which is regarded by a number of international organizations, including Jewish organizations, as a neo-Nazi party. There seems to be little doubt about its Nazi sympathies. We could go into detail about that, but this accusation of an active fascist movement in Ukraine is in that historical context. And the Russians state that the group called the Right Sector, which is sort of the brown shirts that are loosely associated with the Svoboda Party, but organizationally separate, and now there's discussion about them becoming a political party, a different sort of political party as well. But according to the Russian description, members of the Right Sector, masked men seized buildings, fired upon the crowd in Maidan with the intention of creating chaos and the possibility of seizing power. Probably Russian security forces leaked that clip from a conversation between the European Union foreign minister and the foreign minister of Estonia, in which the latter mentioned seeing that it was members of the opposition, that is the anti-Yanukovych forces, firing on the crowd, and she acknowledges it in the conversation. So the Russian view is the new regime brought to power in this way is illegitimate, and also they note it was handpicked by Washington. No one has mentioned yet the Newland conversation with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, in which they're talking about who should succeed Yanukovych, and she is suggesting Yatsenyev, the present figure. The U.S. ambassador mentions Klitschko, Viktor Klitschko, who was another possibility favored by some in the EU, and that's when she famously says, fuck the EU, because he's not prepared yet, he needs more time to do his homework. And, well, it turns out that when the new government is appointed by the post-coup regime, he is the one at the top of it. The Russians point out that the new government wastes no time in rescinding the language rights of Russian speakers in the country and canceling the status of Russian as an equal official language. This is extremely important in a country in which about 40% of the people speak Russian as their native language. And in this country, we think about identity as associated with visual racial markers and with gender and sexuality. But in a country like Ukraine, a lot of identity has to do with language. And Ukrainian and Russian are not mutually intelligible. They're like Spanish and Italian. So if you're suddenly told, as a Russian, you have to represent yourself in court in Ukrainian, it is a major problem. I don't think the U.S. press is giving adequate attention to the alienation felt by people denied their historical language rights. And so, thus, in various areas of the country, dissent emerged without any necessity for Russian agitation. The Russian narrative also includes a lot of detail about anti-Semitism in the new forces, anti-Russian sentiment, and so on. So these are the and also, of course, the narrative continues to conclude that the people of Crimea, of their own free will, demanded to be reassociated with Russia, and Russia accommodatingly allowed them. So it's diametrically opposite to what we're getting in our news. Neither of these narratives necessarily go into the complexities of the fact that Yanukovych had, and his preceding regimes, had all negotiated with EU as well as with Russia. There was never this real clear choice posed between either Europe or Russia. This is kind of a false dichotomy which Victoria Nuland was emphasizing, just as Putin was saying Ukraine can be a bridge between East and West in a Eurasian economy. Well, skipping over some stuff that I think is probably redundant, I want to go way back to the historical question of who are the Ukrainians and what does this have to do with the contemporary situation. Actually, Ukraine is extremely complicated. It's not simply a matter of Ukrainians in the West and Russians in the East. But this is a region that has been populated historically by lots of different peoples, by the Scythians, a type of Iranian people, Celts, Goths before the Slavs, for a time the Central Asian Turkish people called the Khazars established an empire extending throughout most of Ukraine in the 7th century. Its ruling elite embraced Judaism. It's a very, very interesting situation. Jews from Byzantium went to Ukraine, intermarried with Khazars. This seems to be a large portion of the Ashkenazi gene pool, but that's part of Ukrainian history. Then Kievan Rus was established. So the first Russian state was centered around Kiev, which of course now is the chief city in Ukraine. But these were a people of mixed Viking, Swedish, and Slavic origins. They eventually seemed to destroy the Khazar state, but then the state divides into its component parts, one of which, from 1199 to 1340, is really the only independent Polish state that we find before modern times. And its leaders, again, this is before between 1199 and 1340, its leaders did not call themselves kings because they saw themselves as being dukes descended from the old Kievan nobility. And this was destroyed by the Mongols. And then when Ukraine reemerges, it is under Polish-Lithuanian domination. There was a time when Lithuania, which is today a rather small country, extended to Smolensk in Russia. It was a large empire. The Polish-Lithuanian Confederation embraced Ukraine until 1654, when there was a treaty signed with Russia, after which Ukraine became a principality of Russia for 300 years. So again, my point is you don't really have Poland as an independent state with a long, secure history. In 1917, in the disorder of the revolution, the forces in Ukraine declared an independent state, anti-Bolshevik. This was overthrown, and there were fewer than five different Ukrainian states established within a short period of time with different borders. But finally, as of 1922, Ukraine was one of the founding members of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And under it, for the first time, the region to the east of the Dnieper River becomes part of Ukraine. When you hear about West Ukraine, you're basically what's basically referred to is the area west of the Dnieper River, and that has historically been populated by Russian-speaking people. So that was the situation up until 1954, when Nikita Khrushchev, for reasons which are not clear, but probably have something to do with his own personal sentiment, because he was half Ukrainian and had been party boss in Ukraine for some years, he decided to gift the Crimean Peninsula from Russia to a Ukraine. And the official explanation that I've read was that because the economies of Ukraine or of Crimea and the surrounding parts of Ukraine were so thoroughly integrated that this just made sense. But of course, this comes back to haunt when in 1991 the Soviet Union dissolves. And people of Crimea actually petition at that time to be independent or to be integrated into Russia, and there are negotiations, but the matter falls through. But only for 70 years was Crimea part of Ukraine as a part of Russia. So, finally, in 1991, Ukraine becomes independent, but under the control of the same kind of oligarchs who are grabbing large shares of the infrastructure, collectively constructed infrastructure, at this time of collapse. This year of 1991, the year of the Gulf War, which occurs after Soviet, late in the game, Soviets attempt to prevent war, to persuade Saddam Hussein to withdraw his forces from Kuwait. He agrees to do so. That's the worst case scenario for the neocons in the State Department, because it would allow him to withdraw his troops and not have them destroyed, as in fact was the case in Operation Desert Storm. But this is a year demonstrating the ascendancy of the United States, the magnificent of the United States, just as the Soviet experiment seems to fizzle. The Warsaw Pact dissolves in February of that year, and in December, the Soviet Union dissolves. And who is in charge in Russia but President Boris Yeltsin, who turns out to be the rather dysfunctional Russian leader who is in power at the time that NATO is first deployed ever since its formation in 1949. Never really used in war during the Cold War, but in 1994 deployed to hit Serb targets, 300 Serb targets in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia, which had never been part of NATO or the Warsaw Pact. So that is the world in which today's Ukraine was born. Thank you.